So I'll just start out with a little story. Once I was at a meeting for a group that's interested in bringing spirituality into their workplace in a deeper way. And the speaker that evening was a longtime Zen practitioner. I don't know if he was a Zen Zen priest or not. And he gave a very nice Zen-like talk. And it was a good Dharma talk, which I wasn't used to hearing in that kind of setting. So it was a very nice surprise, and it helped me to kind of connect with myself more. And afterward, I was speaking with a couple people. There was kind of some social time, mixer time. And one of them said that she found the teacher to be not very Buddhist. He didn't, you know, he seemed very relaxed and grounded and, you know, kind of big-hearted. And Buddhism is all about struggle, all about struggling. And I was kind of like, okay, suffering, struggling, okay. I could see how that happens. So I told her that I thought she had a misunderstanding and tried to briefly explain the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, its cause, the end of suffering and its cause. And she was somewhat open to that. But I think she pointed to something that, at least for me, has been fairly true in my practice and in the practice of other people who I've known along the path, and that is finding the right amount of effort and energy in practice, finding some balance between enough effort and too much. And that's kind of what I want to explore with you all this evening. When do we know when are we making enough effort or putting enough energy or enough commitment into our practice? And when are we making it a struggle? So, in the, one of the definitions in in the suttas, in the discourses, the Buddha was speaking with the monastics, and he asked them about what is right effort. And here he said, what's right effort? Okay, here someone generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, unwholesome states. So the kind of negative mental states that haven't, if they haven't already arisen, don't go there, kind of thing. And then one generates desire for the abandoning of arisen unwholesome states. So if these negative unwholesome states have already come, then let go of them. To the extent that you can, just really let go of them. And then one generates desire for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. So the good qualities, the faith and the loving kindness and the compassion and equanimity and truthfulness and energy, all these kinds of things. We want to cultivate these. And one generates desire for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase, and fulfillment by development of arisen wholesome states. So the good ones that you have, not just hold on to them, but actively cultivate them. This is your garden here. This is what we want to cultivate. So how do we do that? Well, one of the things that the Buddha said with all these is one makes an effort, at least this is from the translation, one makes an effort, arouses energy, applies one's mind, and strives. This is called right effort. Okay. So this can be, in my experience, this can be a little tricky to navigate. And what I'm really interested in is how often we confuse effort and striving, the unskillful side of striving. Guy Armstrong, who's a Spirit Rock, one of the teachers at Spirit Rock. How many of you know, have any familiarity with Guy Armstrong? You've seen him or heard him or read an interview with him in a magazine or anything? Okay. He's a really wonderful teacher. I encourage you, to, if you have an opportunity, to sit with him, to take advantage of that. He said that in the 60s or 70s, there was this saying about, do the Dharma. And then this, over time, this saying kind of morphed into, you don't do the Dharma, the Dharma does you. You know, and there's certainly some truth to that. But I kind of remember hearing Guy said that he said that he still doesn't think that's quite right. He thinks that the Dharma undoes you. So how do we... There's certainly a place for effort in practice. For effort and energy and cultivating these wholesome states and developing commitment to practice. And yet when we get caught up grasping to achieve certain things in our practice, we can get a little misled, I think. At least in my own experience, I've certainly gotten misled. So how do we work with this? Well, a couple simple ways. I think really in Buddhist practice, one of the really big keys... Actually, I'll give you three big keys. The first one that I would say is mindfulness. Just really... Isn't there going to be a Four Foundations of Mindfulness series? There is going to be a Four Foundations of Mindfulness series here soon. So that I'm sure that'll be really wonderful if you haven't taken it and you have any interest in that and have the time available. I encourage you. And in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it really starts out with mindfulness of the body. So come home just to what the experience is here. You stay to the extent that you stay as present as you can with your own body. It's giving us tons of feedback all the time. So just staying right there can be really helpful. And then you can notice some of the pleasant and unpleasant that arises. On top of that, you can notice some of the mind states that come and go and things like that. So in addition to mindfulness, a couple of other qualities that I think are very important are loving kindness and compassion. Really, just kind of a gentleness with yourself. And that really carries over into others. I mean, to the extent that you cultivate this in your own life just for yourself, others around you are going to benefit from this. So you can bring these qualities to bear in any moment. Doesn't just have to be a moment here on the cushion. You can really just kind of focus on what is, come into the body. What is the body like right now? Is there tightness, tension somewhere? I often get a specific physical sensation when I'm getting craving, when I really want to make something happen, or I want things to be different than how they are, and I'm caught in craving, there's a specific sensation that arises in my body. For me, it's generally unpleasant. And it's a great, for me, it's a very useful feedback loop. It's been a good tool in that way. So you can use that on the cushion or off the cushion. You can use it on the cushion at any moment. When the mind wanders, that can be a good time when you can use it. When you can simply just kind of, it's almost almost like a body scan, very quick body scan. Ooh, where's the, I wake up and there's the mallet again, the mallet on the side of the head for having been bad, for having let the mind wander. Ooh, okay. Just noticing what that's like. There was a, I spent some time, as Maureen mentioned, I spent some time, a brief period of time as a monk in Burma. And there was an Australian man, he was a layman, he never ordained. But he spent, I think he spent 7 or 8 years at the monastery, very committed practitioner. And at the monastery that we were at, the teacher was very focused on having people develop concentration. He really wanted people to develop strong concentration, and then kind of after the concentration got really strong at some point down the road, then the Vipassana practice would come into play. And at different points, my practice was going well or not there, and I can remember talking with this guy about my practice and trying to come back over and over, and was asking him about that, and he did this thing. He's like, you know, I just can't do this. Ugh, come back to the breath, and he'd grab his head and pull, yank it back. And it's really, you know, how often do we use this kind of violence to come back? That can be really instructive and really just kind of focusing on how can I come back to the object, whether I'm sitting, whether I'm walking down the street, at work on the computer, how can I come back into the present moment in a way that's more gentle and compassionate? When I went to the monastery I was at in Burma, it was a pretty overwhelming experience for me initially, and my only prior intensive practice time had been doing meditation retreats here in the U.S. and essentially with Spirit Rock teachers, and I was trying to turn that monastery into Spirit Rock. I was trying to recreate Spirit Rock over there. And it didn't work, you know. It's not Spirit Rock. You know, they're two very wonderful places and very different places. And as I, initially I developed pretty strong concentration, much stronger than I'd developed before. And I liked that. That was good. And then, as with many things, things change over time. And the concentration started to lessen every day. And so when it started to dissipate, I really started to try and crank it up a notch. Really just tighten the screws, just half a turn kind of thing. The abbot, I first met the abbot right here in this room. Paok Seada. And he's definitely a meditation master. Really wonderful guy, wonderful teacher in a lot of ways. Around kind of, if people were kind of tightening the screws or getting striving, struggling to make something happen. I think there were some times, some ways in which I think that he kind of fed that, not purposely. But I can remember once him talking to me about, oh, you know, I had reported on my sits for the previous day, and that was what the interview constituted. And then he said, you know, when he heard about my concentration doing well, he's like, oh, very good, very good. You must say aditana, which is a Pali word meaning determination. Aditana, today I will concentrate for 40 minutes. You know, so keep the mind on the breath for 40 minutes without moving. You know, and this, and then the next day, an hour, and so on and so forth. Or 10 minutes a day, something like that. Now, the Burmese people, in my experience, tend to be very easygoing, very laid back. They have very much of a live and let live attitude. I think culturally it may make a lot of sense to really encourage them to really try to light some fire there. You know, that could be a really skillful way of working with them. I can remember at the meditation hall that I sat in, had two floors to it, had an upstairs and a downstairs. In the downstairs was where most of the laymen would sit. There was a separate hall for the women. So downstairs was where most of the laymen and the novice monks would sit. And basically, almost all of the buildings in the monastery, the almsgiving hall, the dana hall where the people ate their meals, some of the meditation halls or the downstairs of this meditation hall were all kind of residential facilities as well. They'd serve one purpose during the day and then get another in the evening. And so I'd see during the day these monks and lay people sitting quite diligently, you know. And also they could be quite relaxed, and I really respected that. I appreciated their outer form during the sitting. I don't know what their inner form was like, but the outer form looked good. At the end of a sit, they'd go over to where their sleeping mats were, their little bamboo mats. They'd roll them out and they'd lie down, sit around with their friends, lie around, chat, that kind of thing. So in that kind of situation, maybe urging some determination and wholesome striving could be really a useful thing. These Burmese that I was talking about, many of them had a lot of ease in their practice. But I think they could have benefited more by developing more continuity, a little more commitment to practice, a little more steadiness of the energy. That's my view. So I think with the abbot, I think that it was with myself, the urging only kind of encouraged me to tighten the screws more. One of the great experiences I think that I gained from that was really learning to kind of trust my own experience more. Really just kind of trust, what is this in here? Does it feel, what does the effort feel like? What's the actual felt sense like of the effort that I'm making? Yeah. I mean, to some extent, we do have to make an effort, or there is an effort that has to be made. I think that it's in line with what the Buddha had to say about one of the three characteristics being not self, that there's not some kind of lasting, permanent I who is making an effort. There certainly isn't going to be a lasting, permanent I that's going to get enlightened. So really kind of our job is really kind of to commit to the practice and kind of get out of the way. Allow it to undo us. Allow it to just, I think of almost like a big ball of thread or something like that, and taking a needle and trying to, you know, just undo the knots. Let the Dharma will undo those knots for each of us over time. So there is effort. It's important to have some commitment to practice if you want to develop and deepen in the practice. And if you don't use effort, you may end up like those, some of the people I was telling you about who would sit quite diligently and then lie around and chat and talk after the sits. So finding that kind of balance between being too tight and too loose. Okay. Is anybody, how many people in here have heard of Vipassana? I take it most people have. Mm-hmm. Anybody not familiar with Vipassana? Okay. So the Buddha really taught, at least my understanding is that the Buddha taught many different types of meditation, and they fell into kind of two kind of main groupings. There were the Vipassana practices. Vipassana is often translated as insight or seeing into the nature of things. And those practices lead to wisdom. And then there were the samatha practices, which lead to samadhi, or concentration. And these two together, concentration does not, or is said to not lead to wisdom on its own. But I think that, and in my experience, as concentration deepens, the Vipassana, the insight, can be more penetrating. So Vipassana leads to wisdom. What lays the ground for samadhi? What lays the ground for concentration? What kind of qualities or energies help one to, if you really want to do a concentration practice? Really what we did in the sit, the instructions that I gave you were really a concentration practice, really gathering and collecting the mind. Coming back to one object over and over. Does anybody have any ideas? I'm actually opening this up to you all. What do you think leads to concentration?
Focus.
I think effort that you, for concentration, you really have to put some effort into it.
Say more about what you mean by effort.
Sometimes for me, what I consider mindfulness can be a more passive activity. It can be a passive activity, mindfulness. I'm just noticing. Whereas if I'm concentrating, it's a much more intentional thing and requires effort on my part to stay focused, so that you might have a fleeting focus, but you have to rally again and again mm-hmm. to reapply mm-hmm. that focus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the focus, the reapplication, the coming back. Anybody know what the qualities are? Any other ideas of the qualities underlying that focus? Okay, I'll tell you a little story. I believe this is from the discourses. It might be from the Vinaya, which is the monastic kind of code, that kind of thing. So at one point there was this, the Buddha had this lay follower, this woman Visakha. And she asked the Buddha for 8 favors. And the Buddha said, you know, kind of, what are you talking about, favors? You know, Buddhas don't give favors. Tell me more. That's kind of how he responded. That's my take on it. So she elaborates on the favors. The favors had to do with, and she was a wealthy woman. Favors had to do with offering alms gifts of robes to all the monks in her town for life, food for the sick, food for all the monks in that town for life, food for the sick for life, for the sick attendants, gruel, medicine, and bathing robes for the nuns. All of these for life. I don't know if I listed 8 things, but there were 8 things. So the Buddha says, the Buddha asked her, what was she going to get from this? And she said that as she saw or spoke with or heard of members of the Sangha, she'd remembered the gifts that she'd given, and when she remembered that, she'd feel glad. And the gladness would lead to happiness. And the happiness would lead to tranquility of the body. And the tranquility of the body would lead to pleasant feeling. And the pleasant feeling would lead to concentration. And with that, that would help her to maintain the spiritual faculties, the spiritual powers, the factors of enlightenment, and so on and so forth. And this is in line. And the Buddha heard this and he said, okay, you can do those 8 favors. That's basically a good answer. That's the right answer, kind of thing. He consented to allow her to give these alms. So to develop concentration, it does take some effort, and it also takes relaxation. I can remember there's a friend of mine who's a very senior student, been practicing for a long time, and I don't happen to develop particularly strong concentration myself, and this friend of mine does, just has a real ease with it, and I asked him what he did when he's practicing. And he says, he would just spend a lot of time just kind of tuning into where is there tension or tightness in the body or mind and just kind of letting go of it and relaxing it. And he would just do this for a while until he just felt settled. And as the mind starts to settle and get more calm, it is gladness, it is happiness, it is tranquility that leads to concentration. And I think along the lines of focus, which both of you mentioned, it's important to maintain some level of commitment. You know, I mentioned the garden earlier. You know, if you want to eat the ripe, delicious vegetables right off the vine, you know, you'll probably have to have a garden first in order to do that. And then once you get a garden, you'll have to plant the seeds and you'll have to water them and cultivate them and weed them, and it'll probably take some steadiness there. At least that, I think, will give you a better chance of getting those. Maybe, you know, maybe it's just your karma to get ripe, delicious fruit. I don't know. In my own life, I went through an extended period kind of during the dot-com bust or after the dot-com bust. I didn't work in dot-coms, but kind of when the downturn came after that, I ended up getting laid off and went through an extended period of being unemployed and underemployed and, you know, having some work but not liking the work that I had and, you know, and kind of looking for other work. And there was certainly, it was certainly a very fruitful time in terms of practice, and I'm not married, I don't have kids. I was able to do some extended retreat practice during that time, which was one of the real blessings of that. But when it came to being diligent about the job search, I would repeatedly take the pot off the burner. I would look diligently for brief periods, and then I'd get an interview and I'd get a rejection, and I, you know, wouldn't look for a while. And, you know, I just kind of repeatedly let my energy build and then let it dribble away. So I think there's certainly a lesson for me there is finding a way to maintain some steadiness of effort there and energy. These are not things that hold true exclusively on the cushion. This is about life. So you might want to reflect about ways in which you take the pot off the burner in your practice or in your life. You know, what's an area of your practice? Boy, and I'm mentioning those practice and life as if they're two different things. Certainly not. What's an area of your practice, of your life, in which you could take it up a notch? Could be committing to, okay, well, that first hour at work every day. How many people do email at work? Anybody do email at work? Some. Okay. Okay. So, you know, it could be that first hour of email. Every email that you write, you're going to write with a really strong commitment to write speech. Or it could be that in all your interactions at work, that first hour of your work day, you're going to be very careful, pay very close attention to write speech. Not in order to be good. You're really committing to learning from that. Really committing to seeing, what am I doing? To being present with yourself. And I'm sure that some of you definitely know over-efforting well. And you may know over-efforting real well in some areas of your life. But there might be some areas in which you could stand to, you know, maybe take some effort off of this one area and put a little more in something else. So that's something to consider as well. And then lastly, I just want to remind you that to bring mindfulness, loving kindness, and compassion to this as you do this practice with yourself. questions or comments? Yes.
You talked about giving, bringing compassion, loving kindness to yourself. I tend to be very hard on myself, mm-hmm. harsh on myself. And I can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You can use mindfulness with that. I think it's important to... mindfulness is really kind of the main key. So knowing that you're bringing this to yourself or that this energy is present, I think that's really most important. Knowing that it will pass is important. And I think also there's a way in which you could simply deliberately practice, if you're familiar with the metta phrases, with the loving kindness phrases, some simple phrases: may I be safe from harm, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live with ease. You have some familiarity with these, or have your own phrases. I know I've heard Jack Kornfield, who's one of the teachers at Spirit Rock, say that people ask him what's a practice they can do. You know, he says, do metta just for yourself for a year. You know, so that's certainly, that's certainly an option to do that. I think one thing that often people have some concern about when they consider that is that they think that's going to be too much or too self-centered or something. And I just don't think that's true. If you were to practice metta just for yourself for a year, you would be cultivating this bigger heart and everybody would benefit from that. So yeah. Does that address your... Okay.
I'm Joel.
Hey, Joel.
Hi. When you talked about the Burmese sitters that were sitting in the room and then getting up and lolling around and talking, there seemed to be a judgment on your part of their behavior. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know whether that's true, whether you were judging them, and where that judgment comes from in you. And why it wouldn't be all right for them to just be okay with what they did.
In terms of them as people, I had no judgment. There may be some... I may have some judgment about their... I'm wondering... I don't know if I have some judgment about their practice. I certainly... Okay, let me start with what I do know. I do know that I have the discernment that if they want to maintain some steadiness of practice, my sense is that that's not going to be the way to do it. So it may be a judgment in that sense. This certainly was by no means all the Burmese who did this. And there certainly were not, the foreigners were not all, maintaining continuity of practice. I certainly struggled with continuity of practice a lot. There may have been a small amount of judgment there, but I'm not sure that there was much. I'm not sure that there was much outside of the discernment there. Or perhaps my own view that was not going to lead to that they were putting this really wonderful energy in during the sit. And I think the way they were acting between sits was dissipating that energy. So, yeah.
Was it distracting to you?
In your
energy and your need to be more concentrated in your practice?
That's a great question. It was certainly something, you know, I talked about how when I went there, really, my prior experience with intensive practice was doing retreats in the Spirit Rock tradition. And those retreats can be really wonderful. There's quite a strong container that's created there. And all the yogis help contribute to that. Because everybody's maintaining silence. I mean, there were signs up all around the monastery, maintain noble silence at all times. And the Burmese, they talk. They just like to talk. Where are you from? Where are you from? Oh, America. Wonderful. You know, I'm right next to this sign saying maintain noble silence at all times. And it's written in English and in Burmese. You know, so... yeah. So one of the things that I had to learn is if I wanted continuity, I was going to have to do that on my own. Really. And so there was a period there, during that period when I was at the monastery, I did a brief period of a 6-week retreat while I was at the monastery. During that time, I wasn't going to talk with people. And people would be coming up to me several times a day trying to talk with me, and I'd just bow, and that was it. No way. And so part of my learning was, how can I, you know, what's the energy coming from me in the bow? And really trying to get to this place of just bowing to their desire to connect, my honoring that and moving on. Sure.
It was a great question because I was thinking the same thing about, but a couple of things strike me. One is about them not taking the silence as seriously as it you were accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were telling the story, what came up for me was, wow, they seem to have gotten it right. They could sit and be quiet and harness their energy, the right amount of effort, and relax into the community or whatever. That's what struck me mm-hmm. in the moment when you were talking. Because I think one of the biggest... You started the talk about in the beginning about struggle. You know, mm-hmm. Buddhism's about, you know, this is all about struggle. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it could be often how people enter into doing this is because they're really struggling. At least that's been my experience mm-hmm. of talking to people who I've met who've started off on this path. But it seems like the transition of doing these retreats or sitting in a group, you get the community or the energy of meditating in a group. I mean, the hardest thing is, I've always thought in my life, if I could just sit in a monastery, I could probably do that and focus. And I'm not saying I could, I haven't done it. But it's having right effort and doing all this in real life as you deal with life as it happens. And maybe that's the container for it. But the real struggle is how to be in the world daily with right effort and anxiety and illness and all that kind of stuff. And I just wondered when you came back from that and had to re-enter the world, did you do it differently or did all the struggles that exist for you continue, but you were just better at handling them, I guess, is my question.
Yes, certainly it had a profound effect on me. It was a great experience. It was really a wonderful experience. Some things shifted significantly. Generally, that kind of I kind of became aware of that shift pretty gradually over a period of time after coming back. It deepened my practice a lot. And I don't just mean the formal practice, I mean, you know, just kind of my commitment to practice in all parts of life. Does that answer your question? One thing I want to say, to add on to that, and I don't know if this is your perception of monastic life or not, but but something you said reminded me of this. There can sometimes be the perception that if I were a monastic, if I were a monk, if I were a nun, practice would be easier and that kind of thing, and in some ways it is. There's certainly more support. There's more support for practice when I was a monk. It was all about the Dharma, you know. And at the same time, it's not an easy way. But it can be one that can be more supportive of practicing with the Dharma. Yeah.
I'm Rebecca. I'm new.
Hi.
Can you say anything about it? You mentioned going to work and in the first hour trying to focus on having right speech.
Mm-hmm.
And can you say anything about how to, say, try to avoid righteous indignation or annoyance or judgment a little bit? Let's say you have a friend who likes to come and say, oh, my God, this person, and how you respect their desire to connect, as you said, when people tried to speak to you, but at the same time, not get caught up in that. Is that?
Yeah.
Annoyance, righteous indignation.
That's graduate school there. Yeah. Yeah, that can be challenging. That can be challenging. So is it you who's having the righteous indignation or annoyance, or is it this coworker who comes to you with that and then you don't?
And then I share in it.
You share it.
And then we're, you know, that's sort of our.
Then you're going down that road together, right. That path together.
And then we're both annoyed at someone else. And not sharing in it, but without being judgmental about how she is, and
right.
not secretly going back and going, huh, at least I'm more evolved than that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's complicated.
Great. Yes, it sure is. It's great mindfulness, because that'll all come up. All that stuff will come up. So I think I'd encourage you to engage it with some curiosity and some investigation, just kind of check out what this is that's happening. Perhaps what you could do is make a commitment. One of the pieces of right speech is not saying anything bad about someone else. So you could simply commit to avoiding that part of it and just commit to perhaps empathizing with your friend. You know, what is it actually that's going on for her or him? You know, that sounds hard. You know, that sounds painful. It sounds like you felt judged. Whatever. So perhaps you can do that. Things along those lines. And one of the reasons why I suggest doing it for a limited amount of time is because, in my experience, that can make it a little bit better laboratory, kind of. Anytime you're paying attention to it beyond that hour is gravy. But initially you start out with, you know, maybe it's half an hour, whatever, but you're simply going to do it. Or in conversations with this coworker or friend, you're simply not going to go there in terms of your own behavior. And then really committing to learning from the process, noticing what comes up for yourself in this. Irritation yourself towards the person who's being talked about, towards your friend. Does any sense of self arise? Look how good I am. Look how good I am. I'm so glad I don't do that. Yeah. Just noticing that. And as you notice those things arise, also pay close attention to what is your actual felt sense of that? What does that feel like to have those kind of thoughts? Are they unpleasant? Are they pleasant? Are they both? Where do they land in you? That kind of thing. Does that give you some places to start? Okay. Great. Yes. I think this is going to be our last question.
You know, I was not going to talk tonight. I was going to practice silence and let everybody else say something. But whenever I feel a spiritual inclination to say something, then I just run with it, regardless of what I want to do. And going back to this perception of judgment, I've come upon a practice of doing mindfulness in the sense of no assumption, no presumption, no projection, no preconception, and no judgment, but making a judgment call of observation, where if something is too toxic and I feel that vibration, I will allow someone to go to a certain place and then I just cut it off and avoid it. And if it's helpful and it's healing, then I embrace it, like you were talking about earlier, about giving rise to one thing that is not helpful and giving rise to another thing that is helpful, mm-hmm. and not making a judgment as to the person actually doing it, but having that sympathy and empathy and compassion and kindness, but at the same time having those same elements, but on the other side of it, of cutting it off, just saying, okay, well, you know, I have to go now, or keeping a boundary where it's like having too many sodas. You know, it's pleasant to have a conversation, you know, for a certain period of time, but when it gets overbearing, it's like drinking a bunch of sodas. You know, you can have one soda, then two sodas, and then before you know it, you got all this acidy stomach, irritation in your stomach, and it's just overwhelming, and it doesn't seem like a healthy practice to keep on what I call mental masturbation, where it just saturates the brain and just overstimulates the brain to where it's not healthy. And so I just cut people off at that point. I just either walk away or I make some kind of effort to deviate from the subject or say I have to do something, whatever, so that it's not more than what's compassionate for to me or to them. And the question is, I guess, getting to know that balance for each and every one of us is completely individual, I think. And I just wanted some feedback on that.
Yeah, I think for different people that place is going to come at different times. I don't know that my answer is going to be a lot different from some of the other answers I've been giving. I'd want to encourage you to come back to, well, there's a couple things. One would be kind of what I've been saying already, which is to just kind of come back to trusting your inner experience. And that doesn't mean that's exclusively in isolation from others. Having some kind of openness to feedback from the world around you, from friends, family, that sort of thing. I think one other thing is that it's okay to make that decision. It's okay to decide that for yourself.